Well, like measles and electricity blackouts, Formula One is back. Yes, this weekend we'll finally get to see which teams have grasped the nettle, which ones have dropped the ball, and which ones require a different cliche to describe their performance. We may not have the foggiest about what's actually going to happen, but like so many keyboard experts that clog up the interweb, that isn't going to stop us from having an opinion. So joining me, your host Henry Hope Frost, in the Autosport 2013 F1 season preview pod today, our editor-in-chief Andrew Vandenberg.
Hello, Henry.
Magazine editor Charles Bradley.
Hello.
A man who's actually seen a 2013 spec F1 car in action, news editor Glenn Freeman.
Hello.
And our special guest, former HRT and Lotus F1 ace, Karun Chandhok.
Hello, Henry.
Welcome to all of you. So, fellas, let's cut to the chase. What did we learn in winter testing?
Well, probably not an enormous amount, but if you had to really draw a conclusion from it, I'd say the one firm thing we can tell is that Mercedes are probably in a bit of a better position than they were last year, which is great news for Lewis Hamilton and great news for all of us, I think, because him up near the front in a car that's half decent is what Formula One needs, I think.
I think we learned that we need to go testing somewhere warmer, where it's going to be a bit more relevant for the tyre temperature, because I don't know about the rest of you, but I was fairly fed up of reading quotes from drivers and teams saying it's too cold for us to read anything into it.
I think that we just don't need the testing full stop. I think we need like a day each for the drivers to shake the bugs out of the car, get up to speed. And I think that's what the race weekends are for. I think a bit more practice time maybe, because when the cars get to Melbourne, they're totally different from the ones that tested anyway.
We might as well just send them to Rio for a week. That used to work, didn't it?
Classic. McLaren goes 2 seconds quicker on the last morning.
But picking up on the Mercedes thing, it's funny because I went to the first test, and obviously the big story there was Lewis's first week driving the Mercedes. And after the first day he drove it, you know, the main thing that came out of it was, you know, it's an okay car, it's a balanced car, but it just lacks downforce overall. And when I went trackside later in the week, you could see, I watched in the first sector at Jerez, so you get a few different corners or different types of corner to look at. And you could see whatever Lewis was trying so many different things to try and make the front end of the car work. And credit to him, he's really working hard. You could see he had a thought process for the different approaches he was taking. And he just couldn't get the car to work. And he was, by the end of that test, he was saying, well, this team was 2 seconds off at the end of last year. We're not going to find 2 seconds over the winter. And then by the end of the third test, we're coming away saying Mercedes are looking good, they've made the biggest step, and Lewis suddenly is a dark horse for victory.
I was always surprised that Michael Schumacher didn't get the car to work better based on the experience of turning cars into winners. That was a surprise to me.
It seemed like a bit like the team did when they were Braun, that they sort of gave up a bit on last year. You know, I think knowing that Hamilton was coming, and you know, a lot of the chat's obviously already been about next year, as it was if they were forgetting this year. But it seems they did have a little bit more time to get their head straight, sort of readjust the concept, and come up with something that worked a little bit better.
I think looking beyond Mercedes, obviously we've talked about, but you know, the other sort of favourites, I think the Red Bull looks really good. You know, from what I saw on TV, the car just doesn't move. You know, the rear end is so stable, the drivers have a lot of confidence in it. I think the Lotus looks very good on the long runs. If you look at the second Barcelona test, I think it was Grosjean did quite a long run of 20 odd laps, wasn't he? But he was really consistent, and I thought that was a bit of a standout. When you're trying to pick bits and pieces of information that are relevant, and that was quite good. McLaren are the ones that really confuse me. I mean, I think Ferrari are strong, stronger than they were last year, but McLaren are the ones that confuse me, because you were in Jerez, you said, where the car was just mega when they rolled it out of the truck. And then you sort of come away from the third Barcelona test saying, well, what happened there? Because they're quick sometimes and then they're not.
Yeah, McLaren were the opposite of Mercedes, really. Jenson Button did a run at the start of that test on the hard tyre when the track was green. And then you got the impression that everybody thought, wow, that's an incredible lap. And McLaren thought that as well. And thought, right, let's just fill it up with fuel and get on with our test programme. And then they got to Barcelona and they just seemed to have got more and more lost. And coming back to that Grosjean long run you were talking about, we analysed that in a magazine. It was part of a race simulation where he had much more drop-off in the first run. And in the next long stint he did on the same tyre, people trackside were reporting that he drove differently, so he learnt about the tyre from the first run and he was able to manage it, and to have, from what we've seen of all the long runs we looked at, throughout the both Barcelona tests, that was the one run where they had the least degradation of anyone. Where just, you know, if you look at it as a graph, the line is so much more shallow than everybody else's who fall away. So if Grosjean learned something about how to drive for those tyres, as well as the team learned how to set it up, that could stand him in very good stead for a race.
Going back to something that Karun said right at the beginning of this podcast, I still wouldn't rule McLaren out for Melbourne, because it is a completely different beast of a track to the ones we've been testing on, and their record there, and Button's in particular, is absolutely excellent. So while the car might not be this superb aero piece of work that we were all sort of expecting over the close season, I still expect them on this slightly unusual track that has a lot of these sort of 90 degree chicanes to go really well. And it looks like we might have a little bit of rain on the Saturday there as well, and we all know what he's like on those slightly changeable conditions. It could sort of be playing into his hands.
I find it interesting that McLaren have followed Ferrari's lead in the pull rod front suspension, because obviously it caused Ferrari quite a few issues at the start of last year, which, you know, they got to grips with eventually. And, you know, McLaren had the quickest car last year. All through last year we saw that they had generically the fastest car. So why throw that baby out with the bathwater and go for a radical new concept in the last year of a rule cycle?
That's just classic McLaren, though, isn't it? As we say, we know they had overall the fastest car last year, but we've seen it in the past where they've come off an okay season where all they probably need to do is evolve the concept they've got already, and then they come up with something outrageous and radical, and then they spend the first four or five races trying to make it work. They can't resist, can they? I guess they've got all this resource and they feel like they've got to do something else.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the test, I think both drivers commented, and also I saw an interview with Martin Whitmarsh about how they still feel they haven't fully understood it. And you look at the amount of time the car spent in the garage to make changes on it was, you know, because it's, I don't think it's as easy to work on. And I think even the mechanics are still learning, and the engineers are learning how to really set it up properly.
I think that's a very interesting point. When we were doing the launch specials, we did all those side-by-sides or overhead views of the same car. And you look at the Red Bull, from whence knew we got that concept, those cars, they have a really strong family look. You know, you can tell one for the other, they're just small changes, but they all have that familiar rake and the way that he's making it work. Whereas the McLaren, each one looks completely different to the next. They've had those L-shaped pods, they went for the nose that was different to everyone else's. Like you say, that they can't resist trying, oh, we found this is going to work, let's try that.
And it's an accusation that gets thrown towards Newey that he's too innovative, and sometimes if you let him run riot, he'll go and do something stupid. Whereas in fact, if you see this rule cycle, he's done exactly the right thing, and that's why Red Bull's been so successful.
Do you think McLaren will feel the loss of Paddy Lowe? Can one man make a significant difference over the course of the year, or is the sum greater than the part?
No, I think everybody, I mean, Paddy wouldn't be in that position if he didn't have something to contribute. I think, you know, it's not so much about this year. I think it's to do with 14, with the new rules, obviously, and going forward. I think this year's car is pretty much defined. You know, McLaren are a big enough team with a lot of good people. But a person of Paddy's quality and calibre, who's been, obviously, at winning championships at Williams and winning championships at McLaren, you will feel that loss, certainly, I'd imagine.
And don't forget what Jenson Button said at Austin last year when he got asked, how will Lewis Hamilton leaving the team hurt McLaren? And he said, Lewis leaving isn't a big problem to me. He said, the man I don't want to lose is Paddy Lowe. He's the man who's going to help me win world championships in the future.
Whoops. Yeah. We touched on Red Bull. They were somewhat under the radar this time last year and, of course, had a tricky first half of the year. Is it going to be a similar sort of thing?
I don't think so. I think this, you have to look at what happened last year. I think they arrived at the last test. I think they introduced an update which didn't quite work. Was it the exhaust, I think, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, they didn't have the Coanda exhaust to start with, and they were a little bit behind on that part of the game.
And I think it's because they introduced it quite late in the pre-season test, they didn't quite get on top of it. Vettel did, of course, win in Bahrain, but they didn't really get on top of it till Valencia, but they had another update, I think. But this year looks different. You know, the car looks, if you look at it, it's as Andrew said before, it's just an evolution from last year's car, which was clearly the pick of the bunch in the second half of the season. I'd imagine they start Melbourne as favourites.
Yeah, if you're a if you're a proper betting man, then you have to look at the most likely outcomes. And given that very little's changed, there's very little reason to suspect there's going to be any different to last year, and that Vettel and the Red Bull combination is going to be the one to beat. And apart from obviously that opening lap in Brazil, it's been a very long time since the pair of them have dropped the ball, and there's nothing to really make you think that they're going to start doing that now.
You've also got to think with the top teams in testing, I think if a big team is anonymous during testing, then they're probably having quite a good winter. You know, no troubles and no feeling that they need to show what they've got. They've plodded round. They've never ever looked like they're trying to do a lap time, and the drivers have said pretty much nothing to us. So I just think if they're being that quiet and they've looked that anonymous through testing, I'm sure we're going to see something on Saturday in Melbourne that shows that they've had a perfectly fine winter.
One thing I'm quite looking forward to seeing is whether the front wing still flutters like it does when we saw previously, whenever it ran behind another car especially, you know, you'd see it sort of oscillate side to side. They've got much thicker front wing pillars this year, so perhaps it's going to stop it doing that. Perhaps it's still going to do it, but not on when they test it.
Yeah, the load tests are different now, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a stronger load test.
Way and further.
Yeah. So whether it's to get around that and still do it in the racing situation, that's going to be quite interesting to look out for.
I think also you look at the way reliability has gone, I think it's worth looking at for these early races, isn't it? And I think that could be a problem for Lotus. You know, potentially we've talked about their long run pace and how quick the car is, but they've done the least laps of anybody this winter, haven't they? And you know, I know they've had issues with the gearbox, and they've changed clutch supply, which has created a few issues, and they're not having the best of winters from a reliability point of view.
Yeah, and Kimi finished every lap last year, didn't he? Finished every race, and it's only a lap down on the total that you could have done.
Well, it's only because he went up the wrong road in Brazil.
did an Ogier and tried to find a locked gate.
But he knows what he's doing.
Quick word about the sort of middle ranking team, Sauber, Williams. Are we expecting any miracles from those two?
I think the Sauber looks really good. I mean, they've built a good car. I mean, last year they had a good trick with managing the tyres. The car was very light on the rear tyres, and obviously Perez capitalised on that quite well. I think they've got a real star with Nico. If they give him a car that can do the job, he will deliver.
Yeah, it's the most interesting cars with those narrow side pods, isn't it? It's the one that's probably the most visually different in this sort of last year, the rule cycle. So it'll be interesting to see if that sets a trend that everyone follows. Remember the nose slot last year, which they ran? Red Bull have copied that this year, and there's a rear wing around the monkey seat area. They've done a little bit of treatment there, which Red Bull have copied off Sauber too. So I think they might have been barking up the right tree in quite a few areas.
Yeah, well, when I was at the Jerez test, our F1 editor Ed Straw and I went and spoke to Matt Morris, Sauber's technical genius at the moment, and he said something quite telling, I thought. He was talking about getting Hülkenberg on board. He said the great thing for them is that both of their drivers have got the same driving style, so the team only need to work down one avenue. And I sort of said to him, I'm sure that's come from the fact they've both been schooled at ART, the sort of junior super team, who do teach their drivers their way of driving. They don't let you come in and let you do what you feel comfortable with. They say, this is how you would go quickly, do it. And now we've got two of their graduates at a midfield team like Sauber, and they're both driving the same way. And the last thing a team like Sauber needs, with its limited resources and money, is to be going down two avenues. So if those two can work together, with Hülkenberg, of course, leading the way, I think Sauber could be in really good shape.
It's interesting you say that, because there's been quite a few drivers that have gone thinking that they turned up at ASM or ART as it is now, and it's just the best car, and you just drive and you win a championship in it. But it's completely different to that. If you're not prepared to buy into their mindset of how you've got to drive the car, then you don't succeed. And I think what Glenn's saying is quite right. And it's not just obviously Hülkenberg as well. You've got Hamilton and Nico Rosberg, and I think seeing them together in Mercedes is going to be very interesting.
There's 12 of them, isn't there, out of the 22 who race for ART?
Yeah, I was about to say there's more than...
I smell a quiz question coming on.
more than half the grid. But I think exactly as Andrew said, people like Van der Gaard, who raced at ART at the same time as sort of Lewis and Vettel, they struggled, didn't they, to get the results that the
was
others
were
doing.
Was he in the team with De Resta, Kobayashi and...
And you've got to think of people like Maldonado as well. He never fit with the ART scheme of working at all. Never got it.
But no, it was a year... Yeah, it was 2008, wasn't it, GP2? He was struggling big time.
We're talking about this, the relevance of Spain and testing and things. And we go to Australia and Malaysia, which have unique characteristics, and they're back to back. Does any of this form that we've discussed translate into an Albert Park street circuit in a super hot Sepang track?
I think there are elements. I think, as Glenn said, you sort of have to pick and choose which are the bits of information which are important. I think, as you said, the Grosjean long run is quite useful. I think the fact that Red Bull never really took fuel out of it and they've covered themselves quite safe. I think these are all telling signs. But, you know, Melbourne is a slightly, it's an anomaly. I don't think it's necessarily a form guide for the rest of the season. I think Sepang will be the first true indication because it's a circuit that has everything: fast corners, slow corners, long straights, braking stability. That's for me the first true indication.
Normally, what you get from the winter test is a feeling of who's in trouble, but that doesn't really seem to be a sense of that now. I remember, was it 2 years ago, we did a Merck in the Meyer and they were 2 seconds off the pace and they were told, we are not 2 seconds off the pace, and then they qualified 1.9 seconds off the pace. So we were wrong by a tenth, you know. But there's no real feeling of that, apart from sort of, as Karim mentioned, that Lotus hasn't done that many laps. And this point in time of the year, it's when, for those smaller teams, you know, the hay can be made when there is that little bit of unreliability, and we've seen that in the past. You can build up quite a hefty point score in the first sort of half a dozen races that maybe you won't score again. So this might be a chance for you, your sort of Sabre or Force India or someone, to nick a good result.
And not so much a form guide point, but something that might be a curveball this year. Am I right in thinking we've got the super soft tyre at Melbourne this year?
Yeah, they've gone softer, haven't they, from what they had before?
It's a super soft and medium they've got, haven't they?
Yeah.
And we haven't really seen the super soft other than places such as Monaco and Hungaroring and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's going to be a real curveball this time, I think. And I think it's the right call. You know, too often we get later into the season of the two Pirelli years and the teams have worked it out, and then suddenly we go into all these Tilke tracks and we've got medium and hard tyres and stuff like that, and the races get more and more boring. So if Pirelli are going to have the guts to throw the super soft tyre at them a few more times, that could mean that, you know, the teams have got more balls to juggle through the season.
Yeah, and the super softs and the two DRS zones could be interesting as well, because you're obviously going to get quite a bit more traction with a stickier tyre, so that could throw a little curveball into it too.
I'd have cross-blind radio, but
not on the same axle. What? God, no. What am I mad?
Not on your Morris 1100. Coming up to a wet roundabout, as we all know what happens then.
I tell you what we didn't do. We're talking about the sort of midfield teams. We touched on Sava. We didn't actually mention Williams. They're very bullish, aren't they? They're quietly confident. They've got a bit of a monster in FW35.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Maldonado has been raving about it, hasn't he, since he got in it. And actually, to be fair, he got in the car, and on the first morning, I think he did a 22.6 or something straight out the box at Barcelona. And for a car, you know, straight out of the factory, having missed the Jerez test, that was, I thought, good sign. And Williams tend to run conservative. They don't showboat in testing. They tend to run very conservative on fuel. So, yeah, I think they've got a good car again. And, you know, hopefully they can have two drivers scoring points, because they lost a lot of points last year through just silly incidents, really.
Henry, you were with me in that meeting of the Sky talent last weekend.
Was that a meeting when there was 44 of them and just you and me?
Yeah, it was a good chat, wasn't it? Having a private audience.
What a terrible chore that was.
But what they were all saying is that, you know, that having those little vanes on the exhaust which were banned was just a good thing to see Williams do. See that they're actually pushing the boat out, that they're trying these things, because they hadn't seen that level of ingenuity from Williams for a while. And they seem to have, you know, the mojo seems to have come back. I think that win last year sort of really, you know, got them back on their feet and re-galvanised them a bit. And you know, I think they are genuinely most people's second favourite team, and you know, I welcome them being back on the podium again.
Saw a picture this morning of the car with all the bodywork off at the rear, and it's amazing how tightly packaged that is, the sort of around the differential, gearbox, engines, really, really tight.
Yeah, higher diff to keep the wishbones level,
keep the drive shaft level and keep everything in line. And it's really, really, I think it's really good treatment, so I think they could be a dark horse.
And also, I think we're all excited about their new driver, Valtteri Bottas, as well. You know, Williams had done this before. A couple of years ago, they put Nico Hülkenberg in the car, and we've seen what he's capable of, particularly in the second half of last year with Force India. You know, they do know how to spot a star. I mean, I think it's reasonably well known now. They tried to pinch Lewis Hamilton from McLaren in his F3 days, didn't they? And it's great that in this era of pay drivers, you know, Williams, who aren't awash with cash, have once again plumped for another guy pretty much purely on talent, and really hope it pays off for them.
Did you call him Valtteri?
Yeah,
I thought his first name was Hashtag.
It didn't have a hashtag on it to start with, just capital letters.
Another ART guy, of course.
Yeah, you know, the next Mika Häkkinen, the next Kimi Räikkönen, a young guy who hasn't had to do all the formulae, and he's parachuted into a good F1 seat. Could be good. Are we going to have seven different winners in the first seven races again?
Maybe. I think more
what,
like...
What odds would you get?
Oh, you get amazing odds on that. Absolutely phenomenal. I think we may have sort of seven different winners over the course of the season. I don't see there's any reason why both guys from Red Bull, McLaren, Ferrari, and... who are the other lot I'm missing?
Lotus.
Maybe Lotus. You know, so I think, yeah, seven or eight different winners. But I think the likelihood of it being a different one every weekend is unlikely. But I still think, we're at the end of a rules package. The last time we had this was in 08. And I think I'm right in saying that was, in terms of percentage, from the quickest to slowest, the most competitive year we've ever had. And if we take Caterham and Marussia out of the equation, I think this year will beat that. Unfortunately, those two guys are going to forever prevent that from happening, because they're still embarrassingly miles off the pace.
That gives us a valuable insight into a couple of the themes for a later question. Carry on.
And I do, you know, it's a riff on a familiar theme for me. I think it's going to be absolutely fantastic. I mean, Q2 and Q1 and Q3, sorry, are going to be absolutely unmissable. They're going to be, it's going to be so close that, you know, it's literally one missed apex is going to be the difference between the hero and villain in a lot of these occasions.
Is Q3 though going to be incredibly an anticlimax if teams aren't going to go out because they're saving tyres for the race?
Well, also Q1's different because you don't have HRT now. So there's an extra extra car that's going to get bumped off, which is another... Well, it's tricky, is it, for people like Toro Rosso, who are normally on the bubble?
Yeah. To get rid of six each in one and two, don't they?
Well, we were talking about this before we came in, and as we saw countless times last year, qualifying 11th was quite a good place to be if you had an extra set of soft tyres in your pocket, or the softer tyre in your pocket. And also we saw a lot of people not running in Q3 who thought, you know, that the 7th was the limit of their ambition, so why waste a set of tyres? Is that going to be repeated? If you don't think you're going to fight for the front row, you know, are we going to see people like Jensen not doing a time? I mean, it'd be a madness. Surely, if you're a McLaren, you know, those guys have got to go out and try and fight for it. I don't know whether there's anything they can do rules-wise, and they gave them back a set of tyres or something, but you can't have a 10-minute session where half the cars just sit in the pits because they don't think they can do any better than that.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Button, but definitely Perez, the way he looks after tyres in races, the way he charged through in places like Italy
Scores from poor grip positions.
Yeah, and with the extra set of tyres, and starting on the harder tyre, you can see him doing that.
Yeah, but it's slightly different, though. I think if you look at the people who didn't run in Q3, it was typically people like Mercedes and Force India and stuff, who knew going into it they're not fighting for the win. I think a team like McLaren, they're in the business to win, aren't they? I mean, they go into every weekend believing they should be winning. And I think if you want to win, you have to qualify in the top two rows, really. So I think I'd be surprised if McLaren, Red Bull and Ferrari sit out qualifying Q3.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. I think no matter what Perez thinks he can do, if he starts 14th and has all the tyres to choose from, you're not really going to get that luxury at McLaren, because they're going to say, well, for every, you know, you might have one in five races where you have a Monza and you drive past everybody, but we can't afford for you to have the other four races where you don't score any points. You know, even if you're not fighting for the Drivers' Championship this year, you're helping us fight for a Constructors' Championship. But I don't think they're going to afford him that luxury just because he's not an all-out qualifier.
Who do we think's the man most likely to become a new winner? We waited a long time, didn't we, when Nico did it in China? It's got to be Perez or Grosjean, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's got probably those two. But again, you've got Bottas in the mix too.
Oh, Hülkenberg, Interlagos.
Yeah.
But I think if he had 10p to spend on it, on a bet.
The whole 10p?
I think you'd have to put it on Grosjean, really. I think, you know, he, as long as he gets his head together, he is the real deal. He's very quick.
You'd only get coppers back on an each way there, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. As long as, you know, Maldonado's nowhere near him on the grid. He's definitely got the ability to do it, and he's quicker than Kimi on his day.
Given the performance we saw from Perez in Malaysia last year in the wet and the likelihood of there being some rain this time next year in a couple of weekends' time, I think he could do it. I think he could do it quite early on as well. It's for him, though, as we've literally just been discussing, it's whether he's allowed to have that sort of flexible strategy that he got in at Sauber to allow him to do that. But I think, you know, he is quick enough, definitely.
As long as he doesn't do another Will Gollop impression in Malaysia. Nico Rosberg was our most recent new winner. What's the feeling, do you think, about him going up against Lewis Hamilton? I fear for him, I'm afraid.
I think it's a big year for some of these guys. I think Nico Rosberg is one of them. This could be the making of him if he's strong against Lewis. I think Perez is another one. You know, if Perez can show himself well against Jensen, then that's two guys. Is real make or break, and possibly Grosjean. I think this is Grosjean's real last chance to cement himself there.
No, I absolutely agree. And the one thing that we will know for sure at the end of this year, or after the first few races, is how good Rosberg is. Because remember his debut in Bahrain, this was amazing. That charge back
lap,
and fastest
he?
Lap
yeah.
and all that. And he showed really well against Webber. But now we will definitively, let's not forget, three solid seasons of out-qualified and out-racing Michael Schumacher at Mercedes. But it was all really put down to Schumacher's decline rather than anything stunning from Rosberg's side of things.
I was just going to say, I was talking to Dave Manila about this the other day, and he's never one to shy away from having a go at Michael Schumacher. And he said, you know, he's just been up against him when he's with his talent on the wane, whereas he's now going to be up against someone whose talent is very much in the ascendancy in Lewis Hamilton.
Adelaide 94, the and revenge.
And we're going to find out, as Andy says, just how good Nico Rosberg is.
Yeah, because Mercedes don't have an answer to this yet. I remember the last year I covered the DTM was 2010, and there were Mercedes people there who had been talking to people in the F1 team, and they said they honestly didn't know whether Nico Rosberg was out qualifying Michael Schumacher because he's a future star, or because Michael had come back at quite a lower level to what they had before. They never got that answer. So now you've got Lewis Hamilton, you know exactly what he's capable of. We know he's at the peak of his powers. So this year, as Andrew says, we finally get an answer on Rosberg.
With qualifying so important in the modern game, the fact that Nico only matched Michael 10 all across last season against a 43-year-old, that doesn't read nicely at all
just
for me.
Probably not good enough, is it?
No.
Well, we'll find out, won't we? We'll find out at our post-season review podcast, which I'm optimistic will turn into the pubcast. You know,
well, there'll be a Silverstone pubcast, yeah, that's for sure.
We were just touching on Marussia and Caterham. All change at the back of the grid in terms of drivers and personnel. We've lost all the hands are going up. Are they going to break their points duck this year?
My hand was going up because it's just like, over to Andrew and we'll go and get a cup of tea.
Yes.
Well, as I was saying before, you know, the last season was a set series of rules, right? They have had the same set of rules, the same thing to do for four seasons now, and they are still 3-4 seconds, you know, a good solid 2-2.5% off the pace. I don't get it. I really don't get it. I don't see what the point is. I just don't... It's there for the sake of being there. You know, Formula One is the top echelon of motorsport. You're in there to fight for it. You know, you're not in there just to cynically turn up to grab the money for finishing 10th in the Constructors' Championship without really going for it. And the fact that they got rid of all the drivers that are in there, you know, your Glock and your Kovalainens that were your barometers of the pace, you know, people that had finished on the podium of Grand Prix that were, you know, racing for their reputation, to be replaced with guys that are going to make sure that their suppliers' bills are being paid, is a really sad symptom of the state of the back of that grid is in.
Quick tug on the happy stick, just to slow the studio down a bit.
Having said that, I hope Glenn's going to say something nice about Bianchi, because that to me is the one cheery thing that's happening there, because I think he is really good talent.
Glenn, are you as cross?
No, not at all. I'm not really interested in that. But I couldn't sum it up any better than that. But no, I was going to say something happened at the very end of testing that suddenly made that little back of the grid posse a lot more interesting, and that is the addition of Bianchi at Marussia. Because there seems to be a feeling, I don't know what Caroon's picked up, he knows a lot of people as well, that Marussia's, relatively speaking, obviously taking into account what Andrew just said, is a step forward this year, and that they might just have a car, and with a car with Kurz this time, a car capable of giving Caterham a few headaches. And you'd felt that, maybe, you know, just put in a guy like Bianchi, who on his day has got a lot of potential in one of those cars, you know, why can't they suddenly cause Caterham a few headaches on merit rather than last year where they got themselves ahead of them but it wasn't really on pace? So I think now we've got, you know, Charles Pick is a good guy in the lead Caterham, and Bianchi in the lead Marussia. I think it could get quite interesting there.
Well, as much as I think Charles Pick is Ed Straw's favourite driver on the grid, but I think you know, the Bianchi is as you said, has swung the balance on the driver front, certainly towards Marussia. But they, I think they, you know, they run still with about 30% less budget than Caterham do.
And downforce.
Well, I was about to say, I don't know if it's downforce, because at the last test, I'd have to say that the Marussia looks probably a little bit ahead of Caterham, actually.
Yeah, Gary Anderson thought it was quite a neat little car, didn't he?
Yeah, I know Charles a little bit from GP2 days, and when I spoke to him after he drove the Caterham for the first time, you could see on his face that he was absolutely devastated that car wasn't a massive step forward from what he'd been driving the year before. I think he really thought when he was in the Marussia, oh, those guys at Caterham, they've got a much better car than us, they've got all of this, you know, they're so far developed compared to us. And he got in it and realised that the only real difference last year, up until this season, was the fact that the Caterham had a Renault engine and a Kurz system. So I think, yeah, he looked really depressed about it, and no matter how hard you pushed him, he wouldn't talk about how the chassis compared. He always came back to the engine and the Kurz. So I think if Marussia have made a step, then it's going to be really interesting.
Well, the good thing for Bianchi and Max Chilton, let's not forget him, because I know I might have tired them all with this pay driver thing, that he does warrant his place on the grid for the GP2 wins he's got. But having that Kurz, as you mentioned, is really going to help them, because they're not going to get just left behind on the grid anymore. They will have a chance of overtaking. So if they ever feature on TV other than being lapped, it's probably going to be quite a good battle.
Yeah, I think just to sum up, really, I mean, I agree a little bit with what Andy said in his, should we say, sermon about these two teams. But, you know, it is a little bit surprising because they've got good people involved. You know, I think you look at Caterham, Mark Smith and John Eiley, and, you know, now they've got Harry Roberts from, I mean, these are all people who've won races and had podiums with other teams. And Pat Simmons, of course, is at Marussia, and, you know, my old engineer Richard Connell is head of R&D, so they've got good people there. So, yeah, it'll be nice to see them make some progress, but it's the early signs aren't really there, are they?
I've got a question. Has the grid actually lost anything in the departure of Timo Glock and Heikki Kovalainen with the, you know, the GP2 guys that have come in?
Well, I sort of think so. I think both of them still had something to offer, and I think maybe Heikki's head dropped a little bit towards the tail end of last year when Petrov started getting the better of him. But up until then, I thought he'd driven really well there and was probably, would have been a good driver for someone like a team like Force India. I think Glock never let his head drop and always drove really strongly, could still turn in a mean lap. But actually, I'm pleased that he's gone to BMW and a DTM somewhere where his talents are going to be shown rather than, you know, racing for 20th or whatever.
Yeah, the DTM seems to be a place where you couldn't buy a drive no matter how much money you turned up with at the moment, which is really good to see. To answer your question, I think given the machinery that they had at their disposal, they're not a great loss now. You know, Glock, you know, when he came in after GP2 and he was with Toyota, really seemed to be building some career momentum. And if he kept himself in good cars, he probably could have won some races. But you know, if those cars are going to be trundling around at the back and making Andy angry, they might as well be getting some new guys in, grooming them for F1. And we can see them race each other and see which one of them stands out and if any of them deserve to be picked up by another team. So, and I don't think we've lost any potential world champions. You know, we haven't, it's not like there's a Robert Kubica who's lost out to a pay driver. So it's not the end of the world.
I thought you were originally going to ask whether we'd lost anything by HRT dropping out, to which the answer would have been no.
No, I knew the answer to that one before. That's why I didn't ask.
Corinne's just picked up a mic. come on.
Well, I mean, I think it's the only thing I think we've lost is taking on from Glenn's Point, which is there's two less seats on the grid to give two other guys from GP2 an opportunity to get into Formula One. And I think that that's the only loss of it, as I think, you know, the more seats you can have in F1, it does open up some doors for the future, as people like myself and Bruno have found out, I think.
Okay, before we sign off, let me get your tips for the Australian Grand Prix and for the championship as a whole. Karun, who'll win in Melbourne and who'll win the title?
Vettel for Melbourne, and I'd like to see Alonso for the title.
Nice. Glenn?
I'm going to go a repeat win for Button in Australia. I think the McLaren's better than they're maybe making out. And it pains me to say it, but I'm going to go for a Vettel title again.
Charles?
I'm going to read too much into testing and say Romain Grosjean is clearly going to win in Melbourne.
The folly!
But no, world championship, I'll be very boring and say Sebastian Vettel.
I'm going to ape Glenn's sentiments. I think it's Button for Melbourne, Vettel for the championship. But I would love it if Alonso won it, but I just think Vettel's and Red Bull are going to do it all again.
I'm going to say Button for Melbourne, win number four in 5 years, and Fernando for the championship, because he nearly won it with an old you-know-whatter, didn't he, last year? So, you know, if it's good...
Twitter.
Yeah. If it's good this time round, which it looks to be, then, you know, why can't he?
Right, quick, get down the paddy power for the odds change.
Yes. That's it from us. Don't forget you can follow every session in Melbourne and indeed from every race on the website via Autosport Live and read the definitive story of every weekend in Autosport Magazine every Thursday. Thanks to my guests, to Andrew, to Charles, to Glenn, and of course, Karun. Thanks also to Alan Hyde for making us sound more professional than we are. Thanks to you, of course, for listening, and that's a lap.